Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And this morning, we're going to start by introducing you to a city that just became another one of the taste of
cities.
Toronto.
It's curious. It's the first one in North America. It took a long time to get around to North America.
Yeah, why is that? Oh, do you talk about that in the interview?
Well, we didn't really discuss it in great detail because the most important thing was to get the information out there that Taste of Toronto starts on the 24th of July. Just a few days ago, but you still have time to plan to go there and all the information you need to find out more and to get your arrangements and tickets is on the website, but we couldn't pass by the opportunity to talk to the lady who's responsible for making this event happen in this great cosmopolitan city just north of our border. So here's Megan O'Hanlon talking about Taste of Toronto. If I told you that Megan O'Hanlon was Irish, you'd probably believe me, but that's really absolutely not. But Megan, you spent time in various parts of the British Empire as it was, the Commonwealth of Nations as it was. You're now in Toronto, Canada, and you're up to something very adventurous. Tell us about it.
We are. We're launching Taste of Toronto here in 1 week's time. And correct, I have lived in numerous places and had the good fortune of launching and working on Taste of Sydney and Taste of Melbourne, which is part of 20 taste festivals around the world.
Now, whose idea was it to get into this food festival business? It wasn't exactly mainstream for IMG.
No, it certainly wasn't. And 11 years ago, it was an idea to just pull together the best restaurants of the city. It happened to be in London, and it took place at Somerset House, gathered, you know, a number of chefs and food vendors all in one place, and really it was all about a celebration of food, and it was so successful. Started growing mainly around the UK into Europe and started going further, reaching into South Africa, Australia, into New Zealand, Mumbai, all around the world, and this is our first North American launch.
Well, this is the written answer. Of course, the reason we're talking about this today is because, as you said, starting just a few days from now, the very first North American. And I'm wondering, why did it take so long? Did it just take a city as dynamic as Toronto to make this happen?
Well, we've been looking at North America as a market for a number of years. It's always been an ambition. There's many foodie cities, certainly, you know, the obvious ones of New York and San Francisco. But Toronto really has such a unique food scene here. It's really growing. The last 5 years, it's just exploded, and I think really is testament to people like David Chang and Daniel Boulud and Jonathan Waxman opening up restaurants here in the last 2 to 3 years that really made us decide that this was a great place to start.
Now, there are a variety of different aspects of food in Toronto. I remember in the years when we were there, we always headed for Chinatown because it's a very fine Chinatown. But fine dining of the kind that's been emerging in the last few years in Toronto is a pretty new proposition, I think, isn't it?
It really is. The fine dining scene is certainly growing here, and I think certainly the range of cuisine, being a very multicultural city, is a part of it. But on top of the fine dining, there's sort of this sort of no rules element to the cuisine I find here in Toronto that just makes it really exciting and unique.
Now, who are some of the top names who are going to be appearing? And what does their appearance actually consist of?
Well, we handpick our restaurants that we invite down. So we have 14 spaces this year. All of the restaurants, we build them a fully functional commercial kitchen on site. So we're down at a park, so that's no mean feat. And what they do is design 3 dishes per restaurant, signature dishes to reflect what they're doing at their own bricks and mortar space. And they are down there for 4 full days, serving public, sort of tasting plate size, so like a tapas style portion. So we have over 50 dishes to choose from at the event. We've got, as I mentioned, 14 restaurants during the time. We've got everyone from Mark McEwen, from the McEwen Group of Restaurants. We've got Richmond Station, who's Carl Heinrich and Ryan Donovan. Corey Vitello from the Harvard Room. We've also got one restaurant that we're actually, one space that we're rotating a different restaurant each day, which is called our pop-up. And we've got a fabulous lineup in there. We've got on Thursday, Momofuku Noodle Bar. Friday, we've got Yours Truly. Saturday is Hopgood's Food Liner, and Sunday is Valdez. So a real mix, but just a great, great lineup of Toronto restaurants.
Now, how does it actually work? You buy a ticket, but do you buy a ticket for a particular part of the calendar of the show?
Correct. So it's open for 4 days, but within that 4 days, we actually run 4-hour sessions, much like you'd have a lunch or a dinner sitting at a restaurant. So you buy your ticket to one of the 6 sessions. It gets you into the festival. So within the festival, in addition to the 14 restaurants, we have over 60 food and drink purveyors. We also have a number of features as well, which are free to attend. So we've got a large demonstration theater where the chefs will be demonstrating various recipes. We've got a hands-on cooking class, which is free to attend, and our participating chefs and a few guest chefs will be there actually teaching the visitors how to make some of their signature dishes. We also have a tasting room where we'll be featuring mainly wine. We also have some beer tastings in there as well. And we've also got a music stage. So throughout the entire festival, there'll be a whole program of music playing for everyone to enjoy.
So now, so you buy an admission ticket, and you can get a regular one or a VIP one. And then when you get to the food station you're interested in, you actually then buy the food as well?
That's right. So we have an on-site currency, which is called crowns, which originated in London, not surprisingly. 1 crown equals $1. So all of the restaurants sell their dishes in crowns, and it's actually a preloaded card that you can either buy in advance or on-site, and it's literally like a credit card size that you just tap on the terminal at the restaurant, and it deducts your crowns, and you just tap your way around the event. So it's all very seamless, and it's quite a fun way to load up your money and try different food and drink at the event.
So you can you get your food and beverages, and again you pay for them with Taste of Toronto currency, I guess.
Correct, that's right.
Well, now this sounds really adventurous. Now tell us the location is. I'm not incredibly familiar with Toronto, but you said it's in a park, but not too far outside the city.
Yeah, that's right. It's practically smack in the center of the city, and it's one of the most historical parts of Toronto. It's actually held down at Fort York. So the event is actually held within the walls of the fort, and we're fortunate enough to be able to utilize some of the heritage buildings, as well as we build a number of tents where a lot of the exhibitors, vendors, restaurants are set up as well. So it's a really, really unique, amazing space where it's sort of juxtaposed against the backdrop of the city of Toronto.
And if you want more information, the place to go is tasteoftoronto.com.
Correct, that is right. And tickets are available still, and they'll also be available on the door.
And you must be one busy young lady, so I'm going to let you go back to work on Taste of Toronto. Thank you so much for taking the time to call us here today at On the Menu.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited and appreciate the opportunity.
Sounds like fun. Sounds like a great event, doesn't it?
Yep, it does indeed.
So make your plans, and you never can tell who might show up. And in the meantime, now it's time to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, Jenny Britton Bauer is a name that rolls off your tongue just like a nice, clean, smooth sweep of her wonderful ice cream.
She's really into giving away her secrets. So in addition to making the world's best ice cream and providing you with the recipes for that, which she did, I guess, a couple of years ago, she went one step further and with her new book called How to Make...
It's called Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts.
But basically, How to Make Totally Killer Desserts using things in addition to her wonderful ice cream. We all scream for ice cream. Here's another reason why.
Well, it's been a couple of years since we talked to Jenny Britton Bauer, and Jenny just makes the best ice cream in the whole entire world. I was thrilled about your second book. Your first book, I thought, said just about everything I wanted to know about ice cream, and the recipes are authentic, and people can actually make your flavors at home, which in your introduction to this book, you said that people are making your ice cream all around the world.
Oh, yeah, everywhere. I'm getting emails from everywhere, South Africa and Indonesia and Brooklyn and San Francisco and everywhere in between. Absolutely.
And the second book is called Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts, and I want to talk about that, but I had a lingering question. Aren't you nervous about giving away all all your secrets?
Well, first of all, I haven't given away all the secrets. You can make amazing ice creams at home using my recipe, and that is that's the most important thing in the book. But in terms of having a business and making ice creams on any kind of larger scale, it's much more complicated than just the recipe. But first of all, the recipe that I developed for the book was specifically developed for home machines.
Yes,
and so it is actually a little different than what I use. It's based on all the same science that I use to develop our ice creams and what we make our ice creams every day in our kitchens. And many of the recipes are exactly the same, like the hot fudge and the caramel sauce and all of those. But anyway, so some of the secrets, but not all of them.
Right, and besides that, people don't have access to the same ingredients that you have access to.
That's right. As we've grown, we've really increased that kind of access. I mean, like, we can work directly with farmers in Uganda, one farmer in particular, to get our vanilla bean. And it's just the most amazing vanilla bean on earth. And even our dairy, I mean, dairy is not the easiest thing to source.
Right.
The way that we do, and because, you know, we're a little bit bigger, we can get access to those things.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering, when you talk about how everything's still made in your own kitchen, I'm trying to envision what kind of a situation it is where you can turn out these quantities and still remain artisanal.
So we actually have, well, I have three kitchens. I have my little test kitchen where I spend a lot of time, most of my days. And then we have a bakery where we make all of our marshmallows and pralines and cookies. All of our macaroons or inspired cookies are made in that kitchen by hand and Hobart machines and, you know, just the same way you would make it if you were a pastry chef. We have about 25 people who work in that kitchen, 25 to 30. And then we have our ice cream production kitchen, which is several rooms. It's got, you know, we bring in, you know, when it's fruit season, we've got the fruit receiving room where we're bringing 6,000 pounds of strawberries over 3 weeks into our kitchen and have to do a whole bunch of things to those strawberries. You have to wash them and you have to take the top off them and you have to pulverize them and dry them and freeze them and then eventually make them into ice cream. And then we have, you know, of course, our ice cream freezing room with all these different prep stations to make it. But actually our kitchen, the reason I call it a kitchen and not a factory is because it actually looks like a really busy restaurant kitchen at high noon. Stations for everything. There is a chocolate station. There's the caramel kettles where somebody's on those kettles all day long, you know, caramelizing sugar. And so each station has a sort of little area that the person in charge of it is sort of responsible for. And eventually that goes into the ice cream freezing room and then into the pint packing room where we're doing a lot of that in this sort of labor-intensive way. And it's a pretty cool place.
You do the packing by hand?
We have, we do a lot of them, actually with a spatula. And
yep,
we also have them, a few flavors. We have another sort of little, machine that I sort of equate to like a sewing machine kind of type product, but it's sort of a gravity fed packer that helps us move a little bit faster when we have certain flavors can go through that. But a lot of it is just a spatula and hand packed.
It's just amazing. Now, I love your ice creams. You know what I love also is I love the way you think about things, which I think is a very big part of your production. Now, if people hadn't heard the original interview with you, you came to making ice cream from, what, studying art, tinkering with blending perfumes, essences, and then the ice cream. And you say that basically how you make ice cream and how you make such good ice cream is because you're trained in all these areas, because all these areas, art, science, and what all come in together in what you do.
Yeah, I was working in a pastry shop. I had been working there all through high school and into college, and I was studying fine arts and a lot of art history and trying to figure out what I was going to do with that. But one of my sort of serious hobbies was blending perfumes, and I was really getting serious about it. I thought I was going to go to Grasse, France. I mean, I had in my head that that's what you do if you want to be a perfumer. You go, you just get on, you get a plane ticket over there, and you just start meeting people, and you figure somebody will teach you how to make perfume. And obviously that's not true, but I thought, well, maybe I should be a perfumer. I really love the sense of smell. I love layering scents. And I had an essential oil of cayenne, and I blended it into already made chocolate ice cream just to make sort of an edible perfume. Cayenne doesn't have a scent. It just has that physical property on your tongue.
Uh-huh.
And after I took a bite, and it was cold, and it was sweet, and it tasted like chocolate, and then 7 seconds later, it burned my throat. I thought, oh, this ice cream it truly is edible perfume. So then I started using essential oils to make ice cream, and then after that, it was herbs and flowers and things that I bought in the farmer's market. And then it just, 6 months later, this is 1996, 6 months later, I opened my first business in a public market based on those flavors that I've been creating.
Oh, boy. So now, this updated the second book to just the new equipment, speeds and measurements and stuff. But this one carries the whole idea a little further, called Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts. So here's the whole book on frozen desserts. And explain to our listeners how it's divided and what you get in this book.
So the first part is about 30 new ice cream flavors, and there are several new ice cream bases, too. There's a buttermilk soft serve base, which is meant to be served right out of the machine and sort of softer. There is a frozen custard base, which has a very eggy, almost chewy texture. That can be made into many different flavors for any flavor you want.
One of your hallmarks in your ice cream originally was you never used eggs or custard.
Well, we generally don't use eggs. That's sort of our classic ice cream. But, of course, if we're going
to
make something like eggnog,
you have to,
or like this year we had a French toast flavor, or if you wanted to do a sauvignon, which I love, then you want to, of course, use egg yolks for flavor and for texture. But our default is never no eggs. And so, when we use eggs, it's specific, and it's for a specific flavor that we're going for. So I offer that in the book. And then there's another that I figured out how to do on home, but I can't even figure out how to do it in my own kitchen yet on a larger scale. And I call it Crème Sandwich, and it's vegan ice cream, lactose-free vegan. It's just a vegan ice cream base, and it is absolutely wonderful. It is so good that I would serve it to anybody, not just somebody who's intolerant of various things or whatever. So that's the first third of the book. And then it goes into, there's a bake shop section where we have very simple or uncomplicated, I'd say, cakes and pies and things that you can serve with ice cream. These are perfectly served with ice cream. And then there are sauces and other things, gravels and stuff in the back of the book that kind of supports the rest of the book. And the idea is that you take one thing from each chapter and blend them together, or that the real fun of the book kind of lives outside of the book. Each one of the ice cream flavors is really a technique kind of hidden in there. So when you think about a graham cracker ice cream, well, you can also think about using any kind of cracker or any kind of that kind of ingredient to steep into ice cream, but it's really a technique. And the same is true for the cakes in the book. You can use you can layer them into birthday cakes. You can put the sauces in the back of the book in them. You can use any fruits in the pies and empanadas. They're just it's all very flexible. And I think the idea is that in your kitchen, you'll make something that's different from your neighbor and from somebody else in another city. Based on the techniques in the book, it's very foundational.
Now, gravel doesn't sound real appetizing to one who has not read the book, and perhaps to our listening audience who have never heard of gravel before. Can you explain
like
gravel?
Gravel is kind of like a streusel, but we can make it in different flavors. We can make it sort of like a crumble. It's a kind of crunchy ice cream condiment in various flavors. You can do chocolate one or salty graham, and the graham cracker one is really great because it kind of turns any ice cream into a pie. It's kind of like a pie crust. There's a cornbread gravel in there that's really nice.
I saw that, yeah.
Those are really nice in the ice creams, but also on top of the ice creams because they add a dimension. So you could do a honey buttermilk soft serve or honey buttermilk ice cream with cornbread gravel in it, and it's a beautiful flavor.
So is gravel a traditional term used in ice cream?
No, that's something that we created.
Oh, you made it up, okay.
So it kind of has that gravelly.
Yeah, it's sort of like the dessert equivalent of edible dirt.
Of what? Yes.
chefs are now producing edible dirt.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's a little chunkier than that, I would say. But yes, it's kind of in that similar vein.
Well, you know this.
But we have this, there's this thing I call it freestyling the book. And on our website at jennys.com, I have a lot of them already up. But how you combine the different elements of the book, you can make them into very classic desserts, like a caramel tart with rosemary bar nuts. That recipe isn't in the book, but it lives sort of between the pages, and we call it freestyling. When you take one thing from one side and one thing from another thing, and then you serve it with ice cream, and it's sort of like that sort of flexibility. That's what I love about the book, and what I'm excited about is to see how people use it and create their own desserts. And in my first book, people have devoted entire Pinterest pages to the flavors that they come up with based on my techniques. And so I love that sort of handing over the keys to the kingdom. Here are some really sort of base techniques, some foundational techniques. But now you can make really anything you want. And I love that on our website under the freestyling, you can see we have little videos of how you can take one thing and mix it with another thing. And then you have this classic coconut cream cake, for instance, or something else. Those recipes aren't necessarily in the book, but they live outside the book.
Uh-huh.
Now, you have a section, as you get towards the end, you're actually constructing the most beautiful desserts. And as we were joking, as you came on the air, I just said we just got done licking the pages of the book, because presentations are not just delicious, they're also absolutely gloriously beautiful.
The funny thing is, when we photograph everything in our little studio, we make everything there and then just photograph it, but I wanted this book to be more about, to look more like a visual menu, like you could just reach through the pages and grab that off of, out of a pastry case or something, instead of showing it in my kitchen or in my sort of party or whatever, but just showing them sort of like under a flashlight as a visual menu, so you can say, I want this and I want this, and this is exactly what it's going to look like. The photographs are completely imperfect. They're not styled. They're not, that was on purpose. We wanted it to look like what you really will get if you make this ice cream at home. It will look exactly like this. In fact, it may even look better in your kitchen than what it looked like in our studio that day.
Well, you say in your introduction that, which I thought was, again, I said, I love the way you think, and also write. There's a certain, I don't know how to would say, a smartness about it, but also a little poetry about it. You say, ice cream desserts are like my favorite people. They look the best when they are starting to fall apart. Not sloppy, but confidently disheveled, like the late, great Paul Newman stepping out of his race car, or Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, or Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon. I mean, I got all those images at flash and know exactly what you're saying. And you're talking now about how you photograph the book, and that supports this concept.
That's right. It's not meant to look unachievable. It's meant to be confident, and you can do it. And, in fact, your ideas are amazing, and I hope that you will create your own things based on the things of the sort of foundational recipes of the book, and that you'll email me when you come up with something really cool, and that it's not about me necessarily, but it's really about you. And I always tell people, put your name on it. Put my name on the book, because I made the book, right. And I make all the ice cream. I put my name on it. But now it's time for you to put your name on it. That's the fun thing. It's kind of coming up with your own flavor. That's what the fun thing about being an ice cream maker is, or a pastry chef.
Yeah, you talk about that with the J bars, which I think is probably one of the most enticing images.
Do you want to know something about that image? Is that it was actually taken on an iPhone.
Oh, you're kidding.
It was the best one we had, and we decided that we should use it because it was so perfect.
Oh, it's just wonderful.
But yeah, just an iPhone.
Some of these things I've never heard of, like beakies. Was it pikies?
Oh, pikies, yeah.
What are they?
This is an example of how you can use the fundamental of the book to create other things, and it's very simple. I have a sugar dough tart shell in the book that you can fill with all sorts of stuff. You can put ice cream in it. You can put caramel sauce and nuts in it and put it in the refrigerator and serve it with ice cream. You can do all sorts of things with this little tart shell. But one of the things you can do with the dough is you just roll it out and make flat little cookies, any shape cookie cutter to cut them out, or just make them squares or circles or whatever. But then you just dip fruit in sugar and you put the fruit right on top and you bake them together so that the fruit kind of almost becomes like a little bit jammy, and it becomes like this roasted fruit pie-y. So it's almost like a little pie cookie with the fruit on top of it and sugar. Or like a Linzer tort, or, those little cookies, Linzer cookies, where you sort of have that little pie shell.
Oh, right.
Or tart shell dough, which is kind of sweet cookie dough.
Yeah.
And then but instead of putting jam on it, we're just putting very thinly sliced fruit with sugar and baking it that way, and the fruit kind of gets that sort of jamminess. But then you serve it with ice cream. It's almost like a little pie to put next to ice cream. They're very easy to make, really, really easy and adorable to serve with ice cream. They look just beautiful. Well, like the plum ones are gorgeous. They're such pink.
Yeah, it's beautiful to picture that one. You know, you said there's a lot of science to this, and one of the questions I had to ask was, I thought alcohol didn't freeze, and yet you have a number of things like, I'm looking at the moonshine and corn syrup custard with pecans ice cream. How do you get that to freeze, or is it just a matter of proportioning it right?
Yeah, because you can reduce the sugar if it's too soupy. We can just cut back on the sugar, because also sugar doesn't freeze, or not at temperatures that we have it in our home freezers. So you can reduce the sugar, or, you know, if you're just not adding very much of it, it's okay. You know, my ice cream recipe is sturdy enough that even if you add, you know, a fourth of a cup of moonshine to it, it's not going to suddenly become super soupy. If you use a lot of it, then definitely. But we're not adding so much that would affect it too much. You can, and also I adjust the sugar a little bit. So then that helps too. We can get that ratio right. And so it will still be the perfect scooping.
Yeah, another aspect of this book that I think our listeners and people who pick up this book, hopefully they will, what we'll find is you have wonderful little stories about the creations of all these different flavors. And I was interested in the one, the absinthe and meringue ice cream. How did that come to be? You had a story about that.
Well, I do. My friend Ben plays timpani in our symphony in Columbus. And he and the Columbus Symphony did the Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring last year during its 100-year anniversary. And so Ben had this idea that we should do a partnership because it was such an important work 100 years ago, and it influenced so many people in and so many creative people for that sort of 20th century, what became 20th century thinking. And I just got really excited about it, and the more I learned about it, the more I felt passionate about that we need to help tell that story. So the absinthe ended up being the flavor of the ice cream, and the absinthe represented. So the story behind the Red Spring is that when the ballet and the music was released in Paris in 1913, it caused a riot at the event because the bohemian class, which was on the floor of the theater, and then the sort of upper classes that were sitting in the balconies, did not agree. The upper class thought that it was horrible, that it didn't have rhythm, or that it wasn't predictable, and the lower, the people on the floor, the bohemian class, absolutely loved it, thought it was so cool. And they rioted so much you couldn't even hear the music. So we made the ice cream is absinthe, which represents that sort of free thinking, the green of spring, the sort of forward motion of the world. And then we put meringues in it, and the thing we did with the meringues is that we make each individual kiss by hand. They're tiny little meringue kisses, you know, meticulously made in our kitchen. Then they have to dry, and then they have to bake for a very long time. And then we throw them by the thousands into the ice cream. And what happens is it becomes almost like performance art. Over a few days, those meringues disappear. And so the meringues represented that sort of upper class that was unchanging, stiff. They were just like meringues. They were not, never unchanged. And then, of course, what happens is that the Rite of Spring eventually becomes rock and roll and punk music and all of the different things. And Coco Chanel was at that. And all the things that she ended up doing had been inspired by that, too. So the Bohemians won. And so the absinthe sort of wins.
Well, now, I can't, or can I buy this ice cream anywhere? Absinthe and meringue ice cream.
You cannot get it anywhere right now, although we may bring it back this holiday. There's another thing that you can do with that same flavor by adding orange candies to it and even a couple of drops of orange bitters. Then you get something that's called a triumph. It's an old-fashioned cocktail that I love. And so we may do that as a holiday flavor. So it'll be the similar thing with a little bit of orange.
So but I basically, really the straightest shot for me to get these is to use your recipes and make them at home, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. You'll have to make it at home.
Well, again, you came through with a really informative and inspiring and delicious book, and called again Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts, and it's Jenny Britton Bauer. You just do a fabulous job with this.
And thank you so much. We had so much fun.
Yeah, well, sounds like I want to come and make ice cream.
the important thing to note, please note, listeners, because we carried a mistake on our website for about a year, that it's Jenny with one N.
Yes.
That's right. But, you know, if you're in Google, you'll find it. It'll come up. No matter how you spell Jenny, but I spell it J-E-N-I.
Okay, Jenny with one N, thank you so much for joining us today once again. And I'm sure a year or so from now, you'll have something else you've been up to, and you'll come and join us on the program again.
I would love to. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure, guys.
And we'll be back after the break with a rather different recipe book.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, I never thought I would fall in love with a cookbook about broccoli and cabbage, but I sure did with this one. Listen to Laura Russell discuss her latest book called Brassicas.
She knows everything. I never knew that turnips and radishes were brassicas.
Radishes surprised me.
So there you go. Anyway, here's what to do with probably everybody's most hated vegetables, but it turns out that they're really not.
That's true.
Well, okay, you don't think it's
broccoli,
true.
But
well, you do, but you have an unusual taste. A lot of people, including George Bush, dislike broccoli intensely. The Italians think
and I love radishes.
Yeah, the Italians think you only feed turnips to the pigs. There are all kinds of interesting insights and great ideas.
Laura Russell, you have such a resume. I mean, you've done it all. Books, magazines, Food and Wine Select cookbooks. What all? You've done everything. And you were at the Center of the Food Universe in Portland, Oregon. Yes.
Portland is a fabulous food city. It's a good place to be.
Yeah, we like it a lot. Well, I'm looking at this, your newest book, which is visually a real treasure. Brassicas, it's called. Cooking the World's Healthiest Vegetables. Kale, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and more. I have to tell you, I was surprised. I didn't realize that radish was a brassica.
Yes, I think people often think of those big ones that you mentioned, but radishes and rutabagas, arugula, kohlrabi, those are all brassicas as well.
Well, I think that just the images tell people a lot more than most people know before reading this book. And you have sections where you have the photographs of the actual vegetable and the name of it, so that people can look at mizuna and not wonder what in the world that is, as opposed to baby bok choy, Napa cabbage, Chinese broccoli, bok choy. Peter's favorite vegetable seems to be baby bok choy. And that's
right.
One I really don't like, and you gave me the answer to it when you were describing how you're supposed to cook it, because I don't like the texture of it.
Of bok choy?
Yeah, cooked.
Right.
But that's like steamed, whereas you say you're supposed to roast it.
Well, bok choy is one of those vegetables that can, when it's too watery, it can get kind of stringy, right?
That's what I hate, yes.
Exactly. And so I tried to do a few different things to it, grilling, roasting, even sort of a modernized Waldorf salad where I used it raw. That was a really good salad.
Yeah, I like eating it raw, actually. Mm-hmm. When I'm preparing it, I usually cut off the part of it needed, you know, when I'm trimming it.
Right.
Yes. What gave you the idea for this book? Is it just because healthful dining or eating has really become a major issue with American diners, eaters?
Well, I really, I teach a lot of cooking classes as well, and for some reason people seem to be really afraid of cooking vegetables. I'm not sure why, but, you know, a lot of people, their go-to recipe is just maybe boiling broccoli or steaming cauliflower. And when it came down to it, I really wanted to make a collection of easy recipes just to get people cooking vegetables. And brassicas in particular, not only are they're my favorites, but they are also extraordinarily healthy. So I thought, well, if I want to teach people to get these vegetables in their meals, why not choose the really healthy ones?
Yeah, well, you really lay it out here. You have this section called flavor profiles that I thought really was wonderful. You broke it down into mild, stronger, peppery, and pungent.
Yes.
And then you moved on to taming the beast, turning bold flavors into tasty dishes. And you recommend some of the things that just automatically I've always loved but never understood why I was doing it, like anchovies or it's coloratura de something or other, the Italian fish sauce.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And why I would put that on things. You know what I mean? And you explain sort of the science or flavor profile behind it.
Right. And I think a lot of people avoid some of these vegetables because they think of them as bitter or strong tasting. And some of them are. Some of them are also very mild and grassy. But what I tried to do in that Taming the Beast section is just explain how to get the flavors in balance, either how to pair them with a complementary flavor or, like you mentioned with the anchovies, sometimes a really bold-flavored vegetable tastes at its best with something else that's bold, you know, red pepper flakes or anchovies or something salty like the fish sauce or pancetta. And I wanted to teach people how to do that themselves.
Yeah, well, you have the techniques that make brassicas shine, and I don't know that many people, say, roasting, remember the example, the bok choy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many people think of doing that?
Right. That was another, I tried to cover a lot of different techniques in these recipes, because I do think the go-to for most people is boiling.
Sure.
And boiling may be, you know, boiling certainly has its place, but I think as a general cooking technique for these vegetables, it's really not, you know, it's not doing them any favors.
Right.
It's very easy to overcook Brussels sprouts or to overcook cauliflower if you're boiling it. And it also just leaves it very, very watery. So I think something like roasting or sautéing, where you're concentrating the flavor instead of watering it down, is really beneficial.
Well, I liked your section on raw because you got really interesting combinations of flavors by not cooking at all, but just using the stuff raw.
Right. Not every brassica, but most of them can be used raw. And one example, I think most people usually cook turnips. I made a grated raw turnip and apple salsa. And it's just another way to look at the vegetable. You really get that peppery taste from the turnips when it's raw, and there's no reason not to use it that way as well.
Well, you know, I went to a party that a woman had. She was Italian by birth, and she had it catered, and the caterer served the sliced raw turnips. And she was really insulted. She said, "We feed that to the pigs in Italy."
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Well, they probably
do. They were probably delicious.
Maybe the pork would be delicious, huh? Tackle another issue is the smell.
Yes.
I mean, I still remember my mother burning scented candles as she was boiling cabbage.
Right. And that's another area where I talk about the boiling. I tested hundreds and hundreds of pounds of these vegetables and, you know, recipes over the course of a year. And I noticed I only got that smell, that telltale sulfur smell in my kitchen when I was using a water-soluble, you know, a water-based method. So boiling, sometimes if I would cook them in the microwave, that smell really permeated the kitchen. But I found with the drier heat methods like roasting, I never got those smells.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that too, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was one. And you attack the issue of collard greens, which I happen to love. But they haven't made much headway out of the South.
Right. I think that, you know, the Southern preparation, and it's very delicious, is when you really braise those collard greens for a long time. You have some stock, maybe some bacon or some onions, and they're just really, really, really cooked. Those are delicious, but another way to treat collard greens is just to do a very, very quick sauté, almost a stir fry, 2 or 3 minutes, so they barely wilt. They're brighter, and they have a little bite to them, and we'll often just do a quick sauté and serve it with a fried egg for breakfast. That's one of our favorites.
Oh, that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
And a little red wine vinegar wouldn't be bad in it either.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. You tackled another issue here. I love radishes, but it's very hard finding radishes with fresh tops, even at the farmer's market, because nobody bothers saving them. And it's edible. Tell us what you do with radish.
So the radish greens, which I would venture to guess are almost always tossed in the garbage, they're actually very delicious. They have this bright, peppery punch, really. And one thing I'll do is separate the green, if I can find them, like you said, I'll separate the greens from the radish and roast the radishes. And when they come out of the oven and they're still warm,
I'll just toss those radish greens right in. And they wilt a little bit, but I'm using them almost as a salad green.
Yeah, well, it sounds absolutely delicious. You like Asian flavorings too, huh?
I definitely do.
Because you have a whole section on that too.
Right. A lot. There's a whole chapter I call, you know, Asian brassicas.
Yes.
And that includes all the different types of bok choy, napa cabbage, mizuna, tatsoi, Chinese broccoli. And these are some really interesting flavors. They're some of the more mild brassicas. They're sort of grassy. And these can be a little bit harder, some of them, like tatsoi, can be a little bit harder to find. But then I always, whenever I'm making recipes for something hard to find, I give an easy substitute as well.
And then you attack the issue. Why do I keep saying you're attacking?
I'm taming them.
But you have all the health benefits of these various. I mean, can they really be all that healthy? I know kale has been over at the top with everybody and the chefs, everybody racing to deal with kale. But what are, in your mind, are the most important health benefits of these brassicas?
Well, they have many vegetables. They have, you know, a lot. They cover a lot of the vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin K. And then you have all the leafy greens. You can get a lot of fiber and calcium from things like kale and collard greens. But one of the things that sets these apart is the very thing that some people don't like, and that's that high sulfur content. So the sulfur content of the brassicas can be really important in I don't want to make it into a super thing, but in preventing certain types of cancer. This sulfur compound can help in liver detoxification, even in hormone regulation. So, you know, the very thing that's making the cabbage smelly and the Brussels sprouts smelly is also the very, very important thing that's benefiting your health.
Right. And then you have this last section here, you have special diets table. Tell us about that.
I'm always very sensitive that I write recipes that everyone can enjoy. So I made this special diets table, and I listed every recipe in the book and then kind of cross-referenced which recipes are vegetarian or vegan, and then I listed all of the common allergens, dairy, eggs, soy, peanuts. And that way, if you have, say, a peanut allergy, you can just quick glance down the list and see which recipes may or may not work for you. Wow. I also included a lot of substitutions, just so most people can enjoy most of the recipes.
Well, I think you did a fantastic job in this. And I'm sorry you couldn't think of something for our escarole tonight.
You can still appreciate it, even though it isn't a brassica.
So anyhow, Laura Russell, the book is Brassicas, plural, and it's just about all you ever need to know about the vegetables in that category, the health benefits of it, how to cook it, how to store it, how to select it, and also how to really get a lot of flavor in your absolutely exciting recipes.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good talking to you, Laura.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're going to finish up today's program with the story of two sisters and a meal. Two sisters indeed who parlayed a restaurant in Kingston, Jamaica into a TV show that's very popular down there.
And a book
Caribbean Potluck. It's a distillation that you can get for yourself without having to tune into the program, all about the cooking of their part of the world.
Now, you described yourselves as two sides of a coin. Now, I don't know you well enough to know that, but You certainly seem to have had a lot of fun. Suzanne and Michelle Russo from Two Sisters and a Meal have produced a book called Caribbean Potluck, which, when you think about it, I mean, the Caribbean is the equivalent of many different elements coming together and to make something new. Subtitled Modern Recipes from Our Family Kitchen. And your family certainly was, what do you call it, a mix up and blender.
Mix up and blender.
You have something of everything in your background.
Yes, we really do. I mean, and that's very typical in the region. I think a lot of people are not as familiar with that. But because of there's an African influence, you have European influence, you have a lot of East Indians as well that have come to the region. So we are just an example or a microcosm of how many, many families in the Caribbean are, you know, very blended, very mixed, very interracial, from not only from both a cultural, a religious, and a ethnic background.
Of course, when we're talking Caribbean, geographically, what are we talking about?
So, and when you speak of the Caribbean, it's a broad range of islands that span from the smallest, you know, somewhere like Saba, which has very few people, all the way up to aspects of the Caribbean region that are considered to be a part of the Caribbean but are not islands. So you have Guyana, and you have Belize, and you have, you know, other countries that officially form a part of the Caribbean but are not actually islands in the water or the Caribbean Sea. What they feel was once attached to Venezuela, which is the coast of South America. And then Guyana is part of that South American coastline there. And then you have at the top sort of, which is part of the Caribbean, but not in that chain, would be the Bahamas and Bermuda and Turks and Caicos.
Now, what there are foodstuffs that are in common across the archipelago, right? So things like bananas, for example, are pretty much universal. What are some of the other things that our listeners might not realize are actually native to the Caribbean?
I think everything in the Caribbean is not necessarily native to the Caribbean. They've made, they've come across on, I think, through our native populations. They've been brought over by slaves, and they have come from all the various different people that colonized, whether the British, the Spanish, the Dutch, or the French. So what I think all of the islands share are certain ingredients we all pretty much eat. I would say that plantain, green bananas or ripe bananas are always eaten in the Caribbean. I think we eat, as I had mentioned before, we eat widely salted and cured both meats and salt fish or salted cod, salt pork, pig's tail. Those things which would have been the items that would have survived the trek from the UK or to the islands. So a lot of the diets, from a point of view of flavor as well as a point of view of protein, have various types of salted mackerel, salt fish, salt pork, or beef as part of it. So it's used in soups, it's used in stews, it's combined with vegetables, and eaten very much at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I think most of the islands have that. We also have, obviously, a wide variety of amazing fruits, that best pineapples and amazing mangoes, to every kind of orange, tangerine. So we have the citrus, we have others. So there is those things pretty much you find, same with vegetables. Most islands will eat some form of what we call callaloo, which is a dark green leafy vegetable, similar to a kale. Everyone eats it a little bit differently. In Jamaica, it's different leaves sometimes in each island, but that would be a big part of the vegetable part of the diet. So you find it in Trinidad in one version. It's cooked often down with coconut milk. In Jamaica, we cook it down with just onions and garlic and basic seasonings. We eat it at all times of the day as well. And I think coconut would be another aspect that is often across many of the islands. And those that were sugar producers would have the derivatives of sugar. So, you know, molasses, rum, and obviously sweeteners and sugar itself. So I think that's commonly comes in any part of the Caribbean where you eat, you encounter those various things. And so salt fish, for example, in Jamaica is eaten as a salt fish fritter, which is a snack. We eat it at a breakfast with starch and with something like callaloo. We combine it with our national fruit, which is called ackee. Trinidad, they eat salt fish with something called bake.
In Barbados, you go to the east as well. So you find those common threads throughout all of the islands.
Now, there's a spice combination, I guess you would call it, called jerk, which I associate mm-hmm. with Jamaica probably more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Is it really, truly sort of pretty universal in Jamaica?
Jerk is very much indigenous to Jamaica in that it was a form of cooking that was developed by the Maroons who were free men of color during slavery and during the plantation days that resided in certain parts of the island. And as a means of marinating, seasoning, as well as cooking what they at the time would use, which was wild hog, they developed this flavor profile called jerk. They also believe that part of the history and the background of jerk came from Amerindians of whom our native Indians, the Tainos, were descendants. The whole concept of barbecue and barbacoa, and they had this thing called charqui, and I think that jerk was original slaves that were freed by Spaniards when they fled the island when it was invaded by the British. And those slaves went to the hills and ended up coming upon communities of Tainos. So I think they learned all the techniques of cooking and flavoring and stuff were merged from those two cultures. And jerk is definitely a Jamaican phenomenon. It is very much a flavor profile that specifically relies a lot on the use of what is called pimento in Jamaica, or allspice over there. Mm-hmm. And allspice is the predominant flavor as well as pepper that is in it. A traditional jerk would have used what is called bird peppers. Nowadays, in modern versions of jerk, they use the Scotch bonnet or the habanero right. pepper, also very, very spicy. And we visited the Maroons for an episode of our show. They showed us how they seasoned the pork, and they use fever grass, which is actually lemongrass, and a leaf from a bush called pepper elder. And so these are flavor profiles that are not in the jerk of today, but that they use when they jerk their hog or use it on their meats. So in terms of its consumption in Jamaica, it is relatively widespread across the island. It's not an everyday food. I think something like a patty is something that would be more consumed every day by the average person as a lunch or a quick lunch or dinner or snack. It's not served at dinner time. But there are a lot of preparations of outdoor food production. So you would have jerk pits, but you also have pan chicken people who are cooking a chicken on a grill that a lot of people who visit the islands confuse with jerk chicken, but it's actually not really jerk. Jerk is also the method of cooking as well as the flavoring of the meat.
You sure know a lot about food.
Yes, well, we study a lot about food history, you know. That's a big part of the work that we do, especially when we research for the shows that we do, you know.
Yeah.
Answer your question, we would eat jerk. Pretty much, I think, jerk is not consumed as a sort of daily sort of go-to meal. We would eat jerk chicken oftentimes on a weekend, or jerk pork. They jerk everything now. So you can have jerk lamb, jerk chicken, jerk pork, jerk sausage. But traditionally, it would be pork first, chicken second. And you would probably have it at a weekend. It's a very casual, very street food kind of food. We now have a few proper established restaurants that serve authentic jerk. But the part of the island known as Portland would be the place that would have been the original home birthplace of it. But now we have it across the island. We would often eat jerk on the way home late night from a party, because it's oftentimes the place that's open very late at like 2 in the morning. We would eat jerk on our way to the country when we're driving out of town for a long weekend, because often long weekends here are spent going to the beach or the seaside, which is a drive, and there are many, many, many different jerk spaces around on the roadside. So it's eaten sort of, I would say, weekend casual food. It could be a lunch food, but it's not something that would appear on your table at dinner on a regular basis. That's what I would say about it.
One of the things that really amazed me was, is it personal to you, or is mm-hmm. this a strain in the Caribbean flavor profile? There, you have a lot of reworked Italian dishes.
That's very personal to us. I think for us, what happened in our story and around our business was that we were very influenced by Mediterranean cooking, and we had spent a summer holiday with an Italian family when we were, you know, before our business began. That was extremely, I would say, influential and very formative, because we really cooked with them in a very natural setting and learned how simple and really beautiful Mediterranean cuisine can be with very basic fresh ingredients, fresh herbs and olive oil and garlic. And so we cooked and stayed with them a few days between two homes, between their grandmother's home and their own. And when we came back to Jamaica, it was when we started our restaurant, one of the things that there was one place in Jamaica that could give you really authentic, great Italian food. And I think what we felt was that there was missing in the sort of local landscape a light lunch spot where you could have a great salad, a great pasta, a great gourmet sandwich. And those were the things that we wanted to have at lunchtime. And those were the things that we would travel and choose to eat. And so we deliberately decided to have that as the basis of our menu, very much, of course, being influenced from this trip we had spent a few years before. And that then, I think, informed how our business evolved. I think it started very much as a European / Jamaican cafe with those kinds of casual lunch items. And then as we grew in the business and we, you know, went off and did some training and began to read more and experiment more, we began to incorporate Jamaican flavors and ingredients into some of those more, you know, like pastas and traditional recipes very successfully. So it became very much the signature of what we used to do.
Yeah, I'm looking at a recipe for ginger thyme risotto. Now, that's very original to you, right?
Yes, that was a recipe that we had come up with for our nighttime restaurant, and we were trying to develop something to pair with. Actually, it was a local fresh marlin, and we loved risotto, and we had often eaten risotto, but we had never tried to sort of change up the dynamics of the alcohol that you put in there or the ginger or whatever. And so we fooled along with it, and it really worked out.
What's unique about, or what is the general characteristic of Jamaican ginger that's different from, say, Asian ginger?
I think Jamaican ginger is very strong, yeah.
For sure.
And you use a lot less of it to get the same effect. So when a lot of the larger, the roots are smaller, they look a little bit more wrinkly, and they have a lot less juice in them. You know, you can almost juice ginger. You can almost juice ginger that is Asian ginger. If you grate it, you can squeeze out the juice. In Jamaica, it tends to be very, very dense, very rootish, and a small amount goes a long way in its preparation and when you cook with it, because it is very, very, very strong. And we like strong ginger, and we use it a lot in Jamaica in many things, and it's very, very strong.
Well, you know, I think the readers are going to be interested in how you introduce these Italian influences and a modern sensibility into such things as you have flatbread with arugula, prosciutto, manchego, but you also throw in mango, which certainly you wouldn't find in an Italian flatbread.
No, it's delicious. I think for us, this was part of what we always did. I think what I think we spoke about with someone recently was that what has happened is that you have had the culture has changed and evolved and become more modern, but the cooking practices and the food of the region has still remained in a very simple, very rustic, very familiar way. And I think what we were able to successfully do is combine the flavors and the flavors and ingredients and profiles that people were used to having, but with new ways that made the same things that they ate all the time far more exciting. So I think very much for us, the book and the work we are doing is to showcase that you can eat very modern, very sexy, very healthy food, still make it Caribbean, because, you know, Caribbean food has been sort of dropped into this slot of jerk or a patty or, you know, a heavy-duty rice and peas with a gravy chicken. And that really is not what the truth of what the food in this region is about. The range of flavors and the range of ingredients allow for you to make amazing, amazing stuff, very healthy, very nutritious food. But it just takes its imagination, and I think that's what we have tried to do, is present new ways that you can eat, because I think people are seeking more diverse culinary experiences.
Yeah. And I think there are also a lot more crossovers with the cuisines of other parts of the world than people realize. So You know, in Jamaica, thyme goes crazy and it goes wildly and it's everywhere, as does lime. And you know, so when you're looking at, say, for instance, Mediterranean cuisine, the prevalence of garlic and thyme and olive oil and stuff, there's a lot of the same things in the region that grow here naturally. We just don't combine them in the same way. So in the same way in Asian cuisine, you know, the flavors of the mango and the ginger and the coconut, we have it here, but we would cook it a bit differently. And so what we found was that when we took some of the Mediterranean things and mixed them with some of the Asian things and brought it all together, it created a sort of a Caribbean flavor profile that was still authentically Caribbean and not quite like one or the other.
Well, we have the book, of course, that we have with us, and the listeners, you can buy it on our website. You can buy it anywhere else you like to buy books. It's called Caribbean Potluck.
We have a TV show on TV in Jamaica. We have the book. And so we've gone into the business of, you know, food media. That's where we are now. So we're no longer in the restaurant business.
Just tell us about Two Sisters and a Meal. So we know that's a TV show in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So Two Sisters and a Meal is our brand. We have our website, www.twosistersandameal.com. But we're also, the name of our TV show that comes on TVJ, which is a local network. And it's Suzanne and I exploring the island, looking at different people in food, you know, whether they're producers, farmers, restaurant owners, purveyors, and just looking at the stories and the culture and the history behind where we eat, what we eat, and why we eat, and how it has come to be a part of the fabric of the society of today.
We'll have to come down and see you sometime.
Where do you live?
Sure, do. For sure.
We live
actually here in Kingston.
In Houston.
Right, in Kingston, the capital.
You live in Kingston.
Yes, live in Kingston. We were born in Kingston and live here now. We lived for a few years of our life when we were younger as kids in Trinidad.
Right.
We were educated in Canada. And we came home post-university to Jamaica, and our business has been based here and in Kingston since then.
And there's a little cricket they play as well?
Oh, yes, we have lots of cricket here. Social activities for us Caribbean folk.
We better not start on that, otherwise we'll be going all day.
That's like a cricket match.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been fun. It's been fun to find out more about Caribbean and particularly Jamaican food than we ever knew, and you've done a fine job introducing it to the rest of the world.
And you two sisters, we're going to come and party with you because you seem to be really good at that.
Well, yes, we're happy to have you.
Thank you both.
You may never leave.
Thank you
for having us.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Well, there you have it for this week's On the Menu program. We'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.